Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 531, titled Interview with Lucy Commissar About Offshore. This has been recorded on October 30th of the year 2005, and once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to present investigative journalist Lucy Commissar. Lucy, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much.
Now, Lucy, we are talking about offshore. We're talking about the use of separate principalities in order to evade not only financial scrutiny, but to evade taxes, to mask profits, and basically to conduct what is a criminal and amoral or immoral financial system unto itself. Would you characterize that as do you think that's an accurate summation of what offshore is?
Yes, it's the parallel financial system for criminals.
Okay, and a lot of those criminals are some of the biggest names, as we saw inside one, some of the biggest names on the American corporate and commercial landscapes, as well as those of other countries. In some of our past conversations, Lucy, we've spoken about some of the actual gambits that are used in order to evade scrutiny, and I wonder if we could review some of those now. Bear in mind, again, that for the audience, and frankly for me as well, a lot of these things are not nearly as comprehensible as they are to you, and indeed these are mechanisms which are not meant to be transparent. They're meant to be opaque. They're meant to block scrutiny and understanding of some of these machinations. So let's start with the Bermuda inversion. What is that? How does that work? And how is it used by these institutions that go offshore?
It's a corporate inversion. Most of them have been done in Bermuda, but they can be done in some other places. Some companies have used Panama. What happens is a company, instead of creating a subsidiary, creates a new parent company, which is based in a tax haven like Bermuda, and the company and any other foreign subsidiaries become subsidiaries of the new parent. Then the entire corporation benefits from the tax reporting and regulations that are significantly less demanding and expensive than those in the U.S. They go to tax havens where there are not taxes. In the past few years, about two dozen publicly traded companies reincorporated in Bermuda or Panama or announced they would do so. Companies like Tyco, McDermott International, Ingersoll Rand, Nabors Industries, that's a big Houston operator of oil drilling rigs, Accenture, a consulting company which was part of Anderson Accounting. So they're foreign corporations. They evade billions of U.S. taxes. The shareholders, including pension funds, when we think of shareholders, they're not only individual wealthy people, they're also pension funds of trade unions, pension funds of governments, state governments, for example, of state workers. They lose too, because you can't see what the CEOs are doing when it's through Bermuda. The corporate law shifts the balance of control from the stockholders to the company directors. It limits the investor's right to sue. There's no treaty with Bermuda guaranteeing the reciprocity of judgment, so that stockholders may have a hard time getting an American court order enforced. They have a hard time getting information about Bermuda court decisions. The island of Bermuda doesn't even have an official court reporter. So although some of these companies have gotten votes from shareholders to move to do this corporate inversion, they don't tell them that the shareholders are actually losing their rights. And if some of these CEOs are as crooked as the Enron CEOs, they may be in big trouble. There was legislation to block the tax advantages of conversions, but that was decimated by the Republicans. What they did was say it would apply only to future conversions and not to any of the existing ones. It's a real legerdemain, a real trick of saying suddenly you're not the parent company, another company, which is just a paper company, by the way. It's not a real company in Bermuda. It's a piece of paper. They may decide to have a board meeting there. It only exists on paper. It shouldn't be allowed.
And basically what this is simply, in effect, a bookkeeping gambit. It is a paper evasion, but something that has enormous and very tangible physical consequences for those who are on the receiving end of the Bermuda inversions.
Exactly.
Another of the gambits that's used in the offshore ripoff system, so to speak, is something called transfer pricing. And I wonder if you'd explain that for us, Lucy.
Okay. This is a way of evading taxes by moving your profits for tax purposes to pieces of your multinational corporation which are set up offshore, or to secretly owned companies set up offshore. It's always offshore in tax havens. They handle imports and exports. They may buy a U.S. export from a company at a phony reduced price, and then they sell it abroad for the real world market price. So the exporting company back in the U.S. doesn't make any profit. The tax haven trading company makes a profit. Then you do the reverse. You buy goods at a real price. It is bought by this tax haven middle company, and then it's sold to the U.S. firm at a very inflated one. The U.S. firm has a huge cost on its input, and it deducts that when it figures out what its cost is. Sometimes they do things such as sell their logo to an offshore company and rent it back, or they will sell other intellectual property, or they will borrow money at a high interest rate from an offshore company and take the interest off their taxes. The two U.S. professors use customs data to figure out the impact of what they called over-invoiced imports, that is, imports which are set up at too high phony prices, and under-invoiced exports, that is, exports that are set up at too phony low prices. They want to see how would this affect U.S. income taxes, and they looked at the year 2001. And what they did was every item has a number. So a shoe has a particular number, all shoes have a certain number, and all dish towels have a certain number. So they didn't have the statistics for a particular company, but they knew all of the money that was declared for imports of a particular number. And by doing their mathematical calculations, they would come up with an average of what the item was being bought for or being sold for. Well, if you were to believe what they found, you would have to think that companies in the U.S. were buying plastic buckets from the Czech Republic for $973 a bucket, that they were buying tissues from China at $1,870 a pound, that they were buying cotton dish towels from Pakistan for $154 a dish towel. They were also, at least on paper, not getting very much for their exports. So if you were in business, would you sell bus and truck tires to Britain for $11.74 a tire?
11.74 cents.
That's right.
Yeah.
Would you sell color video monitors to Pakistan for $21.90? Would you sell prefabricated buildings to Trinidad for $1.20 a unit? So after the deductions, the U.S. company doesn't have any profits. The offshore centers don't have levy profits, the taxes on the profits that are claimed there. So they put all the based on the stated export and import prices, comparing them to real world prices, they figured out that the U.S. was losing $53 billion a year just from this transfer pricing.
And, of course, with the mounting budget deficits and those in turn helping to add to the national debt, this is a not inconsiderable situation with regard to the economy as a whole.
This is huge. And this is why, this is one of the major reasons why corporations don't pay taxes. There was a study done a few years ago by the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, and they found out that between the years 1996 and 2000, 5 years, that about two-thirds of the big corporations doing business in the U.S. with multi-million dollars in sales and assets, two-thirds of them paid zero federal taxes, zero federal taxes. Most people don't realize that increasingly the corporations are cheating on their taxes to the extent that they pay nothing.
Lucy, one of the things that we've spoken in past interviews about, now obviously the implications of offshore, the implications of captive companies, the Bermuda inversion, transfer pricing, these have enormous effects on matters economic, and obviously those have profound political implications as well. The offshore consideration also has a huge, it weighs in very heavily with regard to national security and intelligence matters, and we've spoken about those in the past. One of the major offshore considerations that you have investigated, and you're practically the only person in the United States that I'm aware of that's talked about this, and that is the Clearstream Network. Tell us what that is, and then we'll talk about some of the things that's been involved in.
Clearstream is a clearinghouse. When individuals or companies trade in financial paper, in stocks and bonds, they need a way to move the ownership papers and the money. They don't send them through the mail. In the same way that there's a dollar clearinghouse for banks, there is a clearinghouse for financial paper. And there are two of them, Euroclear in Brussels, Clearstream in Luxembourg. Clearstream handles billions of dollars a year in stock and bond transfers for banks, investment companies, and multinational corporations. The story that I wrote about is that it operates a secret parallel bookkeeping system that allows many of its clients to hide the money that moves through their accounts. People would want to have track of paperwork for transactions. You have to be able to show that you actually paid for something, so they have to keep records, but they don't want law enforcement to get to some of those records, and so they hide some of those records, and the money involved is massive. Clearstream handles more than 80 million transactions a year. It says it has securities on deposit at $6.5 trillion a year, so this is a very good way to launder money or hide income from the tax collector. Banks are subject to some oversight, except, of course, in the offshore banks. But many of the members of Clearstream, if they use subsidiaries in offshore tax havens to move the stocks and bonds and collect the money, they have the secrecy awarded there. They also have to have secrecy in the clearing mechanism, because what good does it do to have secrecy in your offshore subsidiary that is moving money if the evidence of the trades and the movement of the money is in an institution that law enforcement can get to? So that's why Clearstream has set up a whole parallel system of secret accounts that authorities cannot see. And it gives them, both to banks and to multinational corporations, so they can move stocks and money without any outside scrutiny. That is a story of Clearstream, and it has been written about only in a book called Revelation, French for Revelations, written by Ernest Backus and Denis Robert, and published in Paris a couple of years ago, also translated into German, but not in English.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the focal point of, among other articles, one that you did called Explosive Revelations, with the S's in dollar signs for In These Times, and you've written about it in other places. Lucy, the Clearstream Network has been used, it has cropped up in a number of different contexts. The imbroglio surrounding Mr. Khodorkovsky in Russia, that made the American media, the general spin has been that, well, this is Russia going back to its old Soviet era behavior and suppressing free enterprise and the powerful abusing the less powerful and so forth. But in the very complicated series of transactions that you have written about in connection with Mr. Khodorkovsky and his use of the Clearstream Network, a very different picture emerges. Now, bearing in mind we got a lot to cover in connection with Clearstream, I wonder if you could encapsulate that, and in particular, the realities of Mr. Khodorkovsky's machinations as they affect American investors.
Yes, well, Khodorkovsky and Yukos, his oil company, was a very good example of transfer pricing. They were moving money through offshore trading companies in order to cheat the both the tax authorities in Russia and the minority investors. I saw the documents that showed how they had set up these companies. I saw I have documents showing movement of money through a Swiss bank. It was the basis of the charges that were made by the Russian government, and that caused Khodorkovsky to be convicted and put in jail. Of course, the corporate press never reported on the actual charges, and mostly they spent their time making Khodorkovsky a poster boy for American corporate interests. I think they didn't want to report on the charges because it was all about transfer pricing, and the American corporations do exactly the same thing. Now, the Khodorkovsky's bank, Menatep, was, of course, a client of Clearstream. And one interesting indication of some funny business going on is that Menatep officially failed in 1998, but it exists on the Clearstream company list for the year 2000. What is it doing being allowed to move money through Clearstream in 2000 when it supposedly doesn't exist as a bank anymore? Menatep had set up its account in 97 after Andre Lucy, who was at that time the CEO of Clearstream, actually visited the bank's president in Moscow and invited him to use the system. Menatep set up a non-published account, and many of the transfers were of cash, not for settlement of securities trades. Ernest Backus told me that for at a point where he has actual microfiche evidence, only cash transfers were channeled through the Menatep account.
Mm-hmm. Ernest Backus, by the way, one of the founders of the Clearstream Network back when it was called Sedell.
Yeah.
And now, Lucy, too, the implications, of course, for American investors for the Khodorkovsky constellation were enormous.
Well, yes, a lot of people lost a lot of money. What's interesting to me is another one of the stories that I had tried to get published before Khodorkovsky was arrested and before there was even talk that he was going to be arrested, but the corporate media wasn't interested. In fact, if they had run any of these stories, they would have saved their investor readers a lot of money because the stock of Yuko tanked. It's not worth anything now. Mm-hmm. And the company has largely been being sold off to pay the tax arrears. But the corporate media was just not interested in hearing about this.
Yeah, again, I mentioned that because the spin in the American media was fundamentally different. The idea was, you know, the ham-fisted old Russians were once again stepping on the glorious flower of free enterprise and squashing it, blah, blah, blah. And in fact, what we're seeing was rather some chicanery, very much along the lines of the type of thing that AIG and other corporations have done. And in fact, the people who were actually the losers were the people who were sincere investors in the free enterprise system.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And there is a lot of evidence to be seen. It's not as if you have to wonder whether the people who have made him into the poster boy are venal or stupid. The evidence is there to be seen. There are documents that show the networks of shell companies that were set up by one of his, Khodorkovsky's people in London. And in fact, this fellow, Stephen Curtis, who wrote some memos I have talking about the offshore system, at a certain point apparently thought he was going to be targeted and was in contact with English authorities and was going to see some investigators when his helicopter crashed and he was killed.
Shucks.
This is a little bit like Roberto Calvi in the Ambrosiano case.
Well, let's use that as a transition point. Lucy, we've got a little less than 10 minutes involved. We've got about 7-8 minutes here. We're going to try to do something which is perhaps past a point impossible, but let's see if we can't encapsulate some of the many profound scandals that Clearstream has been involved in and that would be known to the veteran listeners to this program. Let's start with Banco Ambrosiano. Roberto Calvi's alleged killers are on trial right now. How does Clearstream and the Banco Ambrosiano scandal dovetail?
Well, Baca said that he was fired in 1983 because he thinks it's because he knew too much about Ambrosiano. At that time, it was not what was going on was not public, but he became aware of the money being moved to Latin America because it was being moved through Clearstream. The bank was laundering money for the drugs and arms mafia of the U.S. and America. It moved Vatican money, and a lot of money got sent to shell companies in Switzerland, the Bahamas, Panama, elsewhere. And because some of this went through Clearstream, he knew about it. And he only became aware of it afterwards, after the death of death of Calvi and the revelations of what Ambrosiano had been up to.
Of course, Calvi, a member of the P2, a Vatican financial advisor, following in that regard a fellow P2 member, Michele Sindona, who also died under strained circumstances and amidst a raft of criminal investigations that were going on around him. Now, the October surprise, that's something that is relatively well known to members of the listening audience, and once again, the Clearstream Network figures in some of those machinations. Can you encapsulate that for us, Lucy?
Money had to be moved to the Iranians, and Ernest Backus told me that there had been an accord under which the U.S., after Reagan won the election, an accord that the U.S. would release about $4 billion, and the question is how they're going to move the money. This, of course, is all secret. Backus said that Seidel, that was what Clearstream was called at the time, got an instruction from the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank and the Bank of England to transfer $7 million in bearer bonds, $5 million from an account of Chase Manhattan Bank and $2 million from an account of Citibank, both in offshore secrecy havens, the money to go to the National Bank of Algeria and from there to an Iranian bank in Tehran. And he was told, he told me, that the $7 million was part of money being sent from around the world and concentrated in the Algerian bank, and it was linked to the fate of the hostages. The Fed and the Bank of England were not members of Seidel. They had no right to order these transfers, but Backus informed the president of the Seidel Administrative Council and then acted to execute the order.
And, of course, the October surprise itself refers to the deliberate collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages, thereby assuring Jimmy Carter's humiliation and election defeat in 1980. Something that grew out of the dalliance with the Iranians is BCCI, and Lucy, and we've just got a couple of minutes left, but if we could very quickly touch on Clearstream, how it relates to the BCCI scandals, and in turn the milieu of BCCI overlaps that of September 11th, and tell us about the Bank Altaqua. In the last couple of minutes here, before we once again plug the organization that you are developing, BCCI, Bank Altaqua, and September 11th.
Well, BCCI was run via shell companies in the Cayman Islands. It used secret accounts to do an $8 billion global money laundering fraud. One of the recipients of money was Bin Laden. The CIA was sending money through BCCI, and that's how Bin Laden learned all about setting up shell companies and secret bank accounts to do what he wanted to do. He set up, with help of his supporters, the Altaqua Bank, which was organized through institutions in Switzerland, the Gottardo Bank, a very dirty bank in Switzerland, also with accounts in the Bahamas, with Altaqua had an operation in Liechtenstein. And the Gottardo Bank had a Clearstream account. And this gave Altaqua and Bin Laden access to the Clearstream account. Another indication that that Bin Laden may have been using Clearstream is even more interesting in that context. 16 unpublished accounts, secret accounts, were open in Clearstream under the name of the Saudi investment company SECO, the Geneva holding company of the Bin Laden family's Saudi Bin Laden group. It's run by Bin Laden's brother, Yaslam Bin Laden. So clearly, the bin Laden operation knew about Clearstream, and they had two ways of moving money through Clearstream. One was through the Banco del Gotardo, which was the bank in which Al-Taqwa existed, because Al-Taqwa was a shell bank. It had no bricks and mortar. And the other was the 16 unpublished secret SECO accounts.
So when we're talking about matters offshore, we're not just talking about money. We're not just talking about corporate ripoffs and red ink on the books where there should be black ink. We're talking about things that cost a lot of people a lot, including their lives, and things that have exerted a profound, although largely behind-the-scenes, influence on the world and American and national security affairs. Lucy, obviously we've been talking about the problem. You and some others have been developing a vehicle which could help provide at least some of the solution. Tell us about that, and in particular, how people can contact you and what they can do in the context of this organization.
The organization is the Tax Justice Network, and you can go to www.taxjustice.net, info@taxjustice.net as an email address, where you can contact me through that. It was set up in 2003 at the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, largely by groups involved in third world development. They had seen the money looted out of third world countries by corporations and by corrupt officials, and felt that nothing could be done to develop countries in the third world if this looting continued, and that the looting was happening through the offshore system. Money was being sucked out by transfer pricing through offshore companies. Money was sucked out by corrupt officials who were hiding their money in secret offshore accounts, and this had to be the focus. So we started an organization, which is an organization of organizations. It's largely a network, though individuals can also be members. And there is a U.S. group, the Tax Justice USA, which is being organized with headquarters in Washington. People in the U.S. and elsewhere are invited to join, both through their organizations and as individuals. And the goal will be to work with people such as Senator Levin and Senator Coleman, who are promoting legislation in the Congress to make necessary changes. We have an interesting situation where, in some cases, their individuals, such as Levin and Coleman, are ahead of the general public, which does not know a lot about this issue. This real need to develop a grassroots support for those people, because they can't get anywhere as long as the outside commentary on their legislation is all corporate.
Mm-hmm.
If they make a proposal, what happens, who speaks to the members of Congress and the Senate, are the corporations. We have to have the people in civil society begin to put pressure and to get their members of Congress and the Senate to support this legislation. And that's the goal, of certainly in this country and in other countries. It depends on the situation, but to bring attention to this issue. Also, for example...
Yeah, listen, we are all out. We're already over time here, so we got to wrap this up here.
Okay?
Okay?
Yes.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just put a quick cap on this, and what I'm going to do is I'm put more information on the website. And we will... So here's an edit point. I'm going to just count down from three, Eric, sure. Okay? 3, 2, 1... And contact information for this organization will be in the description for the Record program number 531 on the Spitfire website in the For the Record section at www.spitfirelist.com. And listeners are emphatically encouraged to contact the organization to stay abreast of it and to lend support to this critical issue. Lucy, thanks so much for your time and efforts.
It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
All righty. Well, the pleasure is mutual. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 531, interview with Lucy Commissar about offshore. This has been recorded on October 30th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. For Lucy Commissar, thanks for listening.